And they did like degrees in public health.
Yeah, a lot of
this is like on the wrong side. This is for lefties. I didn't think about that. Are you a lefty?
No, it's my pleasure to introduce John Robertson. And, you know, when we have speakers come, the person doing the introduction usually says how much they admire and are friendly with the speaker. Most of that is to be discounted. But in this case, it's true. John and I have known each other a long, long time, been friends for a long, long time, and he is one of the giant figures of bioethics. He has made really seminal contributions in reproductive ethics over the years and in organ transplant. And just to show you the depth of my admiration for him, I think he's wrong most of the time, but he's, in some ways he's both set the policies in some ways he's been someone who I turn to test out and try out ideas and sort of see whether certain arguments will hold up. So he is currently the Vincent and Elkins Chair at the Law School at the University of Texas, where he's been for some time, but I happen to know that he also spent his wasted youth in South Jersey rambling around. We used to exchange suburban growth stories. I was in the burbs of Boston.
But do you have it?
No. The only other thing I can tell you about John is he served on many, many advisory boards. I think he has held the position of advisory board member on the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology for about 47 years. I mean, you preceded the creation of Louise Brown, I believe, you were giving advice to the reproductive medical field. So that committee is just one of many that he's been on. So he is a wonderful bridge between the ethics arguments, legal considerations, and being grappling with some of the developments in new technology areas like reproductive technologies. And in fact, that's what he's going to talk to us about today. He's got a presentation on the impact of new developments in genetic analysis on IVF. So without further ado, and John, we usually leave a little time for them to ask you questions. So,
well, thank you. It's a great pleasure here, and it's mutual. Everything you said about me can be said about you and more. And not that I agree with it all, but really, you said in a lot of areas. And it's a great pleasure to be here at Penn, just because it's Penn instead of a bioethics. But it is my home territory over South Jersey, and I have the special pleasure of having someone I knew in grade school or junior high school, and then in high school, Beatrice Hill, spouse. There are other stories there, but I had her husband, John Hill, from Morristown, New Jersey, who decided to come over and hear this. So I'm really honored by that. Maple Shade and Morristown connection. And they've dragged along a neighbor, Mark Singer, who is an engineer, I want to say bioengineer, but has done a lot of work on medical devices and often works here with people at Penn. So I'm glad you...
Also in IVF.
Also in IVF?
Yes. There's some history of that.
Well, good. I thought people know a lot about assisted reproduction, but it's an interesting topic, and we've been through a major cycles about it. So what I thought I'd do is just review developments there and talk about it as a disruptive technology. And it's fitting to choose this as a topic because in last December, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Robert Edwards, a British scientist, physiologist, who is the leading, is really responsible for the development of in vitro fertilization as a treatment for infertility. And as the Nobel Award presentation noted that the development of IVF and fertilization made it possible to treat infertility, a medical condition that afflicts a large portion of humanity. That his pioneering work represents a monumental achievement that can truly be said to confer the greatest benefit to mankind. The result of his work has touched millions of people by giving them the precious gift of the child. So Robert Edwards. It was a bumpy road. A bumpy road indeed, as all major scientific developments are. Graduate student in the 50s in Edinburgh, he started studying mouse oocytes and fertilization, and then in the 60s, able to successfully fertilize a human oocyte in vitro. The oocytes had been obtained from surgical procedures on ovaries of women they used experimentally. And that itself was a major achievement scientifically, but it took 10 years, or 9 years from that time, for a child to be born as a result, to be able to fertilize a human oocyte in vitro at the appropriate stage and uterus at a time where it would implant and then a baby would be born, which happened in 1978 when we found the first birth. And there are many scientific setbacks and ethical blockages. Itself a very interesting history when people, in history of medicine, history of science, I'm sure it'll be written about at various times and various levels. And now it's a major industry. Much tracked, there's regulatory oversight in a number of nations, not so much in the U.S. Been an explosion in use. 4 million children have been born now worldwide by fertilization, and there are many variations on it. There's embryo freezing, there's ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm ejection, which actually occurs in about half of cycles. Never was really tested, but it became part of the procedure, and there's pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and egg donation, gestational surrogacy, CBOL, which I want to say something about. So what I thought it might be just useful to do is to survey the developments in three areas where IVF has been especially important. I want to talk about its impact. I want to talk about it as a disruptive technology. Disruptive technology, which is a term you're likely to hear at the Wharton School in courses on innovation, because disruptive technologies are known for as a new way. They present a lower cost, a more efficient way of doing something standard, competing with the dominant model. And lo and behold, before one knows it, they take over that field. A prime example is telephones taking over for telegraphy. In the 1870s, Western Union was dominant in the whole field. They had a chance to buy Alexander Graham's patents for $100,000 in 1876. They passed up. Because Western Union, it exists in a small part there. Wiring checks abroad and things like that. But there are many other examples. We're all familiar with disruptive technologies. We live with them. Mini computers replacing mainframe computers and personal PCs replacing mini computers. Downloadable digital music replacing CDs, etc. We've seen it in a lot of areas. I'm not quite sure that IVF is disruptive in that same sense. Assisted reproduction and fertilization is not going to replace coital reproduction. How could it? At least not until some science fiction-y world of the future. It's not going to replace natural coital reproduction, but it offers an alternative for infertile couples who often have a when they get married later on, because 1 in 8, 1 in 9 couples are infertile. It's a major life crisis for them. So it's a supplemental technology, if you will, for them there, rather than a disruptive one. Yet it seemed disruptive to us because of the it's disrupting the natural approach for people who by nature are not able to reproduce. But it's been disruptive for us, I think, in an ethical and legal sense about how to deal with a variety of issues. It's disrupted our ordinary thinking about sex. It's not going to cease for quite a while, even if there are non-coital or even asexual ways of reproducing here. And so what I'd like to do is just review the disruptive impact, if you will, of IVF in three areas: on embryo status, and then on the shape of family, and with a look at prenatal diagnosis and choice and selection of offspring characteristics here. And the overarching theme of this is one of pancreatic liberty. A notion of how to think of procreation and procreative liberty, where the battles have been fought over abortion and contraception and members of the other realm. So what's really innovative in IVF and what leads to these questions is that the new platform, if you will, that in vitro fertilization presents. And this is what I find interesting about the work. So many doors. The ability to pluck out a human egg, or several of them, and then get sperm and fertilize them and create early human embryos gives us a window on the first stages of life that we've never had before. And it's that which is really, I think, significant here. Yes, we can fertilize the egg and put it back in an infertile couple, bypass blocked fallopian tubes. Other problems have a successful outcome there, and we can switch around the egg from the donor and the recipient's husband or partner sperm, and then the recipient can gestate. We have gestational surrogacy. We can have all those things, and I'll talk about them. But scientifically, and in the basic morals, we have access to the human embryo, to those first stages of human life. We can observe it, suspend it by freezing it. We can manipulate it. We can take it apart. We can insert soon to be other genes into it. It's that variety of things that can be done, it seems to me, that is the significant step here, which has a lot of ramifications in many different areas. And if you just think of the embryonic stem cell debate, never would have happened but for in vitro fertilization. The ability to have embryos outside of the uterus, let them develop to the blastocyst stage, and then be able to remove the embryonic stem cells from the inner cell mass, and then guide and observe their development, which leads to pluripotent for all the cells in the body, has opened up an enormous avenue of scientific investigations and opportunities. And it's interesting that Bob Edwards, in the 70s, when he was developing his system, was interested in embryonic stem cells there, and was already investigating with them. Now it took some 25 years later for embryonic stem cells to be cultured in the laboratory, but Edwards was right there once that happened with being able to say a lot about it. So that's a platform I want to talk about here, and then talk about these issues in that context. Now, just a mundane detail about this. We have a whole new set of technical people who do the actual, well, the reproductive endocrinologists stimulate the ovaries and remove, now it's not even laparoscopy, it's by transvaginal aspiration here, needles from the vagina into the ovaries. So we have the reproductive endocrinologists doing that, but it's the embryologists in the laboratory who are doing all the preservation and bringing together, and so it's just a whole new cadre of people who have a power here because of their technical skills that haven't been analyzed or really looked at or studied as such. Just a sidebar here for people in bioethics to think about. But let me talk about the moral implications. You have the embryo outside the body here. The issues of embryo status. And I, with a certain optimistic naivete and others, thought, well, this is going to help resolve the abortion debate, because abortion's always been about fetuses who are much more developed. Here, the right to lifers have talked about protecting life from the moment of fertilization, but it's always been in the context of more developed fetuses. If we have the embryo outside the body, and you can just see that they're undifferentiated cells for 3 or 4 days, that will undercut their position, and we'll have to rethink that at what stages fetuses would be protected. And so that was the notion here. And of course, just the opposite happened. Those who believed in that there is a new moral entity or person from conception, if anything, had more fodder here for their claim here, because there you could actually see it was new, it was individual, rather than undercut the arguments against abortion, it only reinforced them, and indeed then opened up a whole new avenue of bans on embryo research, and of course that led to the whole debates that have raged but have now been, I think we've cycled through that, the embryonic stem cell issues over government funding, though there's a case pending in the District of Columbia Circuit, which will something to say about government funding for that. So we've seen that the issues there, that the moral status, if anything, are just as important or even more so. Embryo outside the body, what status does it have? And that battle will continue for some time, playing out in embryo research battles now. And I want to say something about legal issues, I suppose. I'm a lawyer bioethicist. I teach in law school. I follow very closely various legal issues there, both just common law, state law issues, and constitutional issues. And it's just amazing the number of legal issues that arise. Kathy Taylor here is familiar with these, as are others. First of all, can you talk about ownership of a human embryo? Can you become a person? Is that considered? We don't own persons. Can you own this thing? Well, you can own it if you take the basic sense of ownership or property being dispositional control. Who holds the bundle of rights of what can be done with embryos? And so what got cleared up in the 80s legally was that it wasn't the embryologist and the clinic who brought the egg and sperm together and have it there who are the ones with dispositional control. It's the couple, the providers of gametes here, that if you will own it for purposes of deciding what gets done, whether it's discarded, whether it's frozen, whether it's donated to someone else, whether it's researched on. It also means that if the embryos are taken, are stolen, stealing embryos, maybe in fiction or movies, no, in actual life. The famous case of Ricardo Ashe stealing eggs and embryos of some couples and using them for other couples boggles the mind, but eventually it became clear that he was stealing embryos, and if someone steals embryos or puts them in another woman by mistake or inadvertently destroys them, that they should be liable for damages to the couple who provided the gametes and who had an interest in a potential child there. So that's another issue. And of course, we're familiar with this. The thing that's been most litigated is the couple in disagreement about what should be done with the embryos. If the man is providing sperm, the woman the oocytes, it's a lot harder for her to provide the man sperm. But you have an embryo with their from their gametes, they are joint owners. What if they disagree? How do you handle that? What if they divorce? And we developed a body of law of that. It's turned out giving priority to the couple, like to the person who doesn't want to reproduce. So that's happened as well. And there are issues then, there are constitutional issues looming here that haven't yet been resolved about whether the couple or the person providing the gametes can have a discard problem, can have embryos destroyed, or can have them donated to research and destroyed. Strictly speaking, that's not a discard's a question appropriate, but the use for research is not. And I just want to signal here for you, any legal eagles here in the crowd, here that the abortion cases, Roe v. Wade and Casey, which are major cases of impact on solace, strictly speaking, don't speak to embryos outside the body. They talk about rights to terminate pregnancy. Yeah, when something is inside the body. So the woman's right to have an abortion doesn't apply if the embryo is outside the body because there's no pregnancy involved. And some of the more recent Casey and Gonzalez cases have been become very clear that the state may promote, express its interest in human life, potential people, all the way through the pregnancy, not just from viability, which then means they could do it from fertilization, that the state could has an interest, or if it wished to, in the very early embryo. And so there's the issue, if abortion is involved, what then are the rights of a couple here, and you've got to get into what the meaning of the appropriate is. Now, I don't think that the statements of the state's power to protect prenatal life even outside the body are going to restrict the couple's right to discard embryos. But the question is, will it limit the number of embryos they can create in the first place? Will it limit what other things the couple might do with the embryos as they're not using them for reproduction? So a number of issues there where the new platform has raised issues that we'll have to deal with. So that's embryo-related issues. Let me talk a little bit about family-related issues. That's the other area. Second area that's been of much concern and interest here is new forms of family. Well, we've got adoption, we've got foster children, we have divorce, we have blended families, we have all kinds of variations. So now what IVF handles doesn't seem like much at all, but it's not nothing because first there's some time shifting of fecundity going on here. Women need to be less concerned about having families early on and can be more devoted to careers, professional jobs, etc. if IVF is a backup. Also, if egg freezing before fertilization becomes safe and effective, it's not yet, it's still experimental, idea of women that has a short system, but for their fecundity, go through a stimulation cycle, get a lot of eggs in their early 20s, freeze them, and then later on, if they're not able to, if they haven't had children, they postponed it to later on, they may then have a partner, be married, if there are issues of fertility, they'll have eggs of a much younger woman. So there's some interesting possibilities there. But the main areas where family formation has been affected by IVF has been egg donation and gestational surrogacy. And egg donation is in some ways a more important one, because here you can take the egg from one woman and fertilize it and put it in another woman. It's been a great boon to older women who don't produce as good eggs in their late 30s or 40s, or have premature ovarian failure. So there are some interesting possibilities there. It's only about 3,000 children born a year through donor eggs, but it's quite successful. And so there's some interesting questions here that arise, and it's these ethical and legal issues I'm really interested in that are presented. Is the woman who receives an egg donation and does a gestation, is she reproducing? Which then would implicate her reproductive liberty. Well, she's not genetically reproducing, she's gestating. Should that experience of gestating be as valued and be given the same constitutional and moral significance here? And there are few laws as such that address parentage here. Most people assume that the agreement between the parties will control. It probably will, but we haven't had that tested. And of course, there are the issues of donor rights, which the egg donor is undergoing significant risk and injury. It's usually paid for. She can be injured. She's not just giving up rearing a child that may be from her eggs. She could be have a hyperstimulation syndrome. It's not very frequent. And there are going to be infections. So there are issues of protecting the woman as well in egg donation. I think that's the most important ethical and legal in egg donation, making sure that the donor's rights are protected of her being able to get medical care if she's injured in the process. And it's just amazing how important it is to have that spelled out in the contract. And the other issue is payment, which of course has gotten a lot of play. No doubt there are advertisements in Daily Pennsylvania for egg donors, young women wanting to be egg donors, and often large sums floated, maybe some bait and switch going on. Very interesting thing, this is something Art knows a lot about, the National Organ Transplantation Act in 1984 that was banned paying money for organ transplants, the use of organs and tissues in transplants, really designed to keep people from selling their kidneys to others, had an exception for renewable tissue, for sperm and blood and eggs. Eggs aren't renewable, a large supply, but just interesting that exception. There's not an exception for bone marrow, that's a different story. But so there are a number of issues related to the egg donation. Of course, the other area is gestational surrogacy. You can take the embryo of a couple, and instead of putting it, say, in the spouse, the wife, you can put it in another woman who's the gestational surrogate. This is different than the baby M case, where the woman provided the egg as well. And so there are issues there as well. This doesn't happen as frequently, maybe 800 or 900 times a year. And so it's just interesting what the impact of this is. And one of the areas in which it has a major impact is, surprisingly, and this Bob Edwards never thought of this, and people did not early on, even when egg donation came in the late 80s, but it has become now a mainstay for gay male reproduction. The combination of egg donation and surrogacy has male couples or single men who want to reproduce instead of getting a traditional surrogate mother who would be providing the egg that has some legal problems, they now are put together an egg donor and egg donor and a gestational surrogate, and one of them will provide the sperm. And so it's interesting how this technology now is reinforcing the movement to recognition of same-sex marriage. Lesbians are able to do sperm donation. They don't really need IVF. They might have some cases, but it plays a bit as well. And there's some more exceptional cases you can talk about. I actually have a colleague in the law school at the University of Texas who was not able to produce eggs herself. Her husband could provide sperm. She could carry the pregnancy. She wanted two separate egg donors. And so she carried and had twins with two separate egg donors, and wrote about it. Here, I see her husband wrote about it. I'm not. So that doesn't happen very much. And the New York Times had a cover story. I sold some newspapers a few months ago of a woman using one egg donor, but two surrogates, but at the same time. So these are. Let's say they're bizarre. They're just little things that happen in the way. Obviously, blended families, adoption has much more of an impact. But and of course, you could have a person who doesn't have any gametes hire, get the sperm donor, get the egg donor, get the gestational surrogate, and then they can arrange to do the trial. So these are some variations. Legally, there's some interesting questions about if there's a constitutional right to use these means to procreate, to what extent that extends to controlling the rearing relationship vis-a-vis the donor and the offspring. That's an uncharted territory in constitutional law. Indeed, state family law has trouble keeping up with it, but it's just an area that might eventually come around as part of the recognized right to marry and have a family. Does that extend to using these more exotic techniques where some of the biologic gestational marriage is split up? And so they will disagree in a case a few years ago concerning grandparent rights versus natural parent rights. But this may come back. Well, the third area. Genetic selection. And here there is a disruptive effect, but I think it's easy to just the technology cases only so far. And here, just think of prenatal diagnosis now through karyotyping in the 60s, which was developed, and amniocentesis. Soon after that became routine for women over 35. For Down syndrome, and then with Coriandel sampling developed in the late 80s and earlier here, and now with alpha-fetal triple screen protein screening can be done for anyone. It's routinely done in pregnancy. Most women, whatever age, will have at least that triple screen. And then you have further invasive diagnostic techniques if that screen is positive, and then can go through the cycle of terminating the pregnancy if they wish as a result. So that's where standard now, widespread use of prenatal diagnosis. Well, IVF offers the possibility, before there's been any pregnancy, to pick which to identify the genetic, the chromosomal, and even genetic makeup of the embryos and decide which ones will be transferred into the uterus as a result. Here, and it can be done for couples who are carriers of autosomal recessive disease, you're quite familiar with that, you folks in bioethics, you can do your cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs or other screening of if you're both carriers of embryos. You don't have to get pregnant. The 1 in 4 chance that the fetus is positive goes through the termination. You can go through IVF and then pick embryos. And of course, you could then pick for non-medical related conditions, such as the sex of the offspring. And as other genes are identified that are related to non-medical characteristics, there are a few at the moment, perfect pitch. Eventually, there may be sexual orientation is not yet there, but it might eventually be. There'll be certain kinds of athletic ability, a fast twist, slow twitch muscles, and maybe IQ variations. And as these become available, if they become available, there could be an increased use of IVF to select embryos and select offspring as well. Now, this is where people start getting concerned, because this then can have effect on people with disabilities. It can make the child to be sought for its characteristics, not for itself. It will lose its gifted status, as Leon Cass and others say. It's a eugenic program, if you will, so there are a lot of concerns about that. And of course, this then leads to, does one have the right, if one has a right to reproduce in these ways, to select the characteristics of offspring, which is an interesting issue that will eventually have to be fought over. But there's some solace here. We in bioethics love to analyze these issues. They're interesting topics. They're a little cutting edge. They're not quite here. They probably aren't going to get here very much. The technology really is a limiting factor. First of all, the genes. For the characteristics of interest are determined by many, many genes. There's no single gene for most of the characteristics of interest, so there's a technological limit on being able to one piece. Secondly, you have to go through IVF. If people are otherwise fertile, the idea of not coitally conceiving, but going through an IVF cycle with its intrusiveness and its cost would be unnatural on how pre-implantation genetic diagnosis based on IVF is going to be used to change in any major way our relation to offspring in choosing their characteristics. In a few cases of people who are autosomal recessive or other disease traits. I'll tell you, the technology that's really going to have an impact is non-invasive, early prenatal diagnosis. You may know about this now, which is based on cell-free fetal DNA and RNA that's circulating in the maternal bloodstream. Say at 4 or 5 weeks, a blood test of a woman who's pregnant can identify that this is fetal DNA that's free of any fetal cells, just pieces of DNA. It's now been established that can be used to diagnose Down syndrome and some other things, and pretty soon you'll be able to get the whole genome of a conceptus, a fetus, based on a blood test at 5 weeks, which would open up the possibility then of a medical abortion, which can be done up to 9 weeks. And the real kicker here is that having a routine blood test at 4 or 5 weeks of pregnancy without any discussion of all these ramifications, and then suddenly being told that here we have, we can give you a readout of all the risk factors that your baby may be prone to, and a lot of other non-medical traits as well. Here, how is that incorporated into the obstetrical system? Does it require, before the blood test is taken, all the full range of genetic counseling that one would receive? It hardly seems likely that that's going to happen, because it takes so much time. Who can do it? Here, which means, and if the doctors don't take the blood test, they're going to get hit with wrongful birth suits if a child is born with something of concern. later on. So there'll have to be some system worked out here for counseling of women with regard to self-breeding fetal DNA. For those who like the scientific acronyms, it's small CFF large DNA, cell-free fetal DNA here. And a concern, the reason I bring this up, that as this becomes perfected here, it's going to give a lot of non-medical indications as well, which is then going to be to those groups concerned about creeping geneticization of our children to pass laws against giving in certain kinds of information, certain kinds of genetic information that will could be used to terminate, say, technically, a fetus up to 9 weeks. So for the first time, we're likely to get a real attempt to restrict the reason for abortion, which has not happened here. And it's not because it's going to be a major challenge to the Supreme Court. Does the right to terminate a pregnancy up until viability include the right to do so for any reason, or will the woman's reasons be investigated? She may have good reasons, she may have bad reasons, but now there may have to be... Well, for the abortion itself, it's going to be hard to police that, but it would then be debated on what's turned back. It's that interesting intersection of both of us. Well, the final point about genetic selection and alteration would be then actual genetic alteration. And I note that in 2007, 2008, the Nobel Prize under Mario Benetti and a couple others for homologous recombination, the ability to change the DNA of an organism. That led to the oncomice used to engineer mice. But that technique of homologous recombination of DNA, basically the technique that would be used for genetic alteration in human embryos as well. You do somatic cell nuclear transfer, that'd be another technique as well, but it would be the homologous recombination here. The Nobel Prize Committee seemed to be recognizing what is has the most some disruptive possibilities. So that's again something to think about. Again, I think the actual alteration of genes is going to be unlikely. That the technology is a limit here. People who can reproduce coitally won't want it unless they're at risk for a child with a serious disease. But if they are, they can do PGD. They usually have enough embryos that are healthy, so why would they want to do the alteration? Maybe if they want to try to engineer some special traits, but that's going to be a very limited universe of people as well, I think. So here's where I'm optimistic about the technology, but I'm also optimistic that it's not going to lead to as many nightmare scenarios for quite a while to come. So, what we have here is disruptive technology, okay, transformational, okay, but also domesticated. Yes, it raises a lot of interesting issues within each sub-area and challenges for people treating fertility and proper regulation of that field. So couples are treated respectfully, not abused, etc. And maybe we'll get some other disruptive technologies in medicine. There are others as we different cancer treatments come online, ways to control aging, there'll be other parallel disruptive techniques that will replace others and raise issues. But with regard to assisted reproduction, Bob Edwards deserves the Nobel Prize, and Mario Capecchi and others do as well, and there'll be a lot of benefits. But I think we've seen that we can domesticate the disease, which will take care of the worst nightmarish fears. And bioethics has largely done that to an avalanche, ongoing series of articles from the very time that Edwards started out and ongoing now, and different aspects as they develop. Yes, the market will take care of a lot of this. The professional research is involved. We have national commissions. We have courts and legislatures, and together they come in a way to domesticate what appears to be a disruptive technology and make sure that it's facilitative of community good and not disruptive. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'd love to answer questions and discuss this or anything related. Jonathan.
So one of the little discussed outside the fraternity of stem cell biologists implications of induced pluripotent stem cells is that you could actually, an individual could be cloned, including mitochondrial DNA, which of course is not possible under the technology that we have for embryonic stem cells for somatic cell nuclear transfer. But with iPS cells, you could take, in principle, any cell in your body. And
right.
If you could figure out the right combination of genetic factors, you can turn it into a blastocyst. I mean, that's, people like here, like John Gearhart, have been talking about this since the last 2.5 years. So what do you think? Would that stimulate the return of, it seems to me it would, of the question of the law around human cloning, which is kind of stalled for various political reasons, human reproductive cloning?
I think it probably will raise it. So let me say a couple things about that. By the way, when I mentioned embryonic stem cells, the IVF platform leads to embryonic stem cells, but then it leads to this further development of induced pluripotent cells to get around the ethical problems that some people had using leftover embryos and destroying the embryos to get the ES cells. So we then embarked on another technology here of induced pluripotent cells of any somatic cell of the body being able to induce that into all the tissues of the body, all the cells of the body, including gametes. And I know people here at Penn have done work on that, and Art has been involved in reviewing some of the ethics of that, which raises some interesting possibilities of if you could get an oocyte from a man, you could. A woman's skin cells could produce sperm here, and so you'd get some interesting variations on two mothers, the family with two mothers that still have to be a gestational mother, but then is the genetic father actually the biologic father as well? I love it.
Or you could get a blastocyst just from an individual's somatic cell.
Yeah, just a blastocyst and be another way of playing. So there's some possibilities there which go to the meaning of family and how one, what that right is here. The concern is having a genetic connection with offspring. Cloning, whether through nuclear transfer cloning or through the induced pluripotent cells, is certainly having a genetic connection with offspring here. It's almost as full as you could get. You'll still need an oocyte. It won't be the mitochondria. So those issues will come back online. But again, I think, yes, they will. It'll lead to some interesting papers, maybe conferences. It's not going to be the major alternative, because if you think cloning, who's going to use it, even with somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning, who would engage in reproductive cloning? Well, people who are truly infertile and don't have gametes of any sort, which is going to be a very small number, who don't want to use sperm or egg donation here, and so maybe they'll want to clone themselves. And you could argue for those who are truly gametically infertile, some form of cloning should be permitted if it's the genetic connection with offspring that is valued in procreation here, and then the rearing as well. But that's going to be a very small subset. Those who could otherwise, coitally or through assisted reproduction, reproduce, wouldn't have the same claim to engage in cloning unless the right to control the genetic makeup of offspring is so broad that would include the right to clone as well, not just to have children of your that are related to you. Because if you could do that by other means, why would you need to clone? But that just shows how this technology then, with the IPS cloning, you are going to need a gestator. So you might need some variation on IVF to get there. So the platform leads to that, but again, interesting issues. I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact except on a few. There'll be some variations, but it does put pressure on the meeting, appropriate liberty, and how we resolve that, which will be a complicated but we can enforce legislators, professionals. Some others. Yes?
I had a question. My name is Matt Dragon. I'm a med student, MB student here. And there's a recent article in New England Journal about new testing, carrier testing for autosomal recessive traits beyond your typical Tay-Sachs and CF. And with the new age of next-gen sequencing and hybridization that they're coming across. And they're proposing a test for some 448 recessive disease mutations that they could do. And one of the things they talked about in terms of marketing was two IVF clinics. So my question really is that in the process of coming up with this carrier testing, they realized that there was grave discrepancies in the literature about what the actual disease mutations are. As this new next generation sequencing tells us more and more about actual mutations and having to decide what is a disease mutation, what isn't. Should there be any regulations for IVF clinics receiving this kind of next stage testing that has a lot of ambiguity about what is actually a disease, what are the risks, especially these disease types that have variable phenotypes, anywhere from mild developmental and cognitive impairment to severe consequences.
That's a major issue now. Throughout this area of what do you do with the varied risk here, and if the phenotype varies, the penetrance of the genetic disease is limited. How do you handle that? You have to think of couples. I mean, who's going to go through this? And if you're talking about people going through IVF, so they have embryos. Maybe they have no indication that they have carriers of genetic disease. Maybe they will want to then have some testing done of the embryos, but it'll be another procedure. There may be a little risk to the embryo. Maybe they may or may not want to do that. They're mostly interested in having successful outcome. They may be less interested in choosing, but maybe some of them will, and then you'll have to face there. Well, what are you going to tell them? What if they agree to pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, for what conditions, and what are you going to tell them? And are they going to have enough embryos to make so you can get some risk factor for 100 or 500 diseases or conditions? And each embryo might have some of that, as we all do. Which embryos do you pick? You're going to have enough embryos that will be free of any here. So how do you resolve that? I don't know if you'll need governmental regulation right at the start. The FDA would kick in if it's a test here. It's being marketed. I don't want to put too much faith in the IVF programs as such, but they're not totally irresponsible, and there's going to be a dilemma that they'll have to deal with. How much testing are they going to do? Because of what are they going to tell people? How much additional income will they get from telling people about these? And then they have to have the genetic counseling set up. And the same is for those couples who go through IVF and PGD. because they're at risk for, say, autosomal recessive diseases. So they find out where they are in cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia, but now they have all this other information.
Yeah.
Now, information overload. And maybe at some point you have to go to some regulatory effect of that, but I'm not sure at the moment. Maybe some lawyers will drive it with wrongful birth lawsuits, but something to worry about. But I think you have to watch and see if it's that serious a problem. Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering if you could comment on like transplantation of reproductive organs, like
Now you're talking about cadaveric
uterine
there, as opposed to uteruses from hysterectomies that are donated to others. I'm not sure if a woman is having a hysterectomy for uterine reasons, not usually talking about a living donation there. I mean, you have to start breaking it down, and this is stuff that artists are the leader in working out here. The distinction between all the talk about transplantation and paying money for transplantation, you have to distinguish between living and cadaveric, related, non-related, are you paying money or not? So you have to see where the donation comes from, and maybe there'd be a use cadaveric donation of uteruses there. It wouldn't be directly reproductive for the deceased, so it would not have the same implication as if you were transplanting ovaries that are retrieved at death, which then to ask the family to consent to that then opens up the possibility that they're going to have genetic offspring from their deceased daughter. Their number of issues there. So I think you have to think about it in those terms. Look, you can see a sister who has a healthy uterus, has had children, and now wants to donate her uterus to her other sister or someone else in the family. Yeah, in theory, that should be fine. Help her reproduce instead of being the surrogate for her. But we'll have to see how that plays out, the safety and efficacy. The issue that I think is closer there is ovarian donations or taking slices of an ovary, cadaveric or otherwise, and raising issues of a new generation of progeny of the person.
Question, you talked about ownership rights. Can you comment on the ownership rights of the gestational surrogate relative to the embryo?
To the embryo?
Or to, I'm sorry, to the
child?
Yeah, to the child.
Well, it's interesting how the field broke down. We had Baby M in 1988. Great case, Mary Beth Whitehead takes, who's inseminated where with Mr. Stern's sperm, has the child, it's her egg, and she has some visitation. She takes the child and goes on the lam to Florida and is eventually tracked down. It headlines left and right before the 24-hour news cycle. It would have generated a lot there. And the New Jersey Supreme Court held there that the agreement doesn't control, doesn't bind, that the full surrogate there retains visitation and custody rights, can't alienate them by contract. Lo and behold, a few years later in California, the Johnson v. Calvary case, where there's a gestational surrogacy involved, they hold the opposite. That if there's a case of gestational surrogacy, then there's two biologic mothers, the gestational surrogate and the egg donor, and that as between the two, well, you go with the prior agreement, which was the woman who provided the egg there, that her agreement, her husband's agreement to be sole rearers of the child, was given effect. And so that then was the legal infrastructure for the whole field of gestational surrogacy to become embedded as part of assisted reproduction. It's part of the CDC statistics that are collected, the number of gestational surrogates. We don't know anything about the number a full surrogate's, and so there the custody rights, I think, are pretty clear. Gestational surrogate, part of the couple controls. Now there's the last twist of fate here is that the New Jersey Supreme Court, which had held in Baby Yam, which wasn't gestational surrogacy, that the surrogate retains rights, now has a case with two gay males involving a gestational surrogate, actually the sister of one of the male partners here, a gestational surrogate, who had agreed that the two men would be rearers of the child, now is reneged on that agreement, and so the issue before the New Jersey Supreme Court. It'll be interesting to see whether they distinguish Baby M and go with the California child, which you might be on either side of that. But even if they don't, that'll be just in New Jersey, and most other jurisdictions follow. The gestational surrogate does not have rights to
this. Pre-implantation genetics, pre-implantation screening. Sorry, does genetic screening, does it limit reproductive autonomy of parents?
It doesn't. You could argue that it actually enhances it because it gives them information about what the characteristics of their child would be and gives them the chance to then avoid having a child with a serious disease or being at risk for adult onset. So in that sense, you could say it enhances autonomy. Now, it also would give someone who wanted to control what they do power as well, but we're not there in the United States, and you know, it doesn't seem likely. So I find that genetic screening on the whole, and prenatal diagnosis, and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and non-invasive early prenatal diagnosis, that they all enhance the autonomy of a couple or individual who's looking to have a healthy child here. They enhance autonomy. There are technologies, there's some problems, but they're autonomy enhancing. Yes, sir. Art.
So, this is just a procreative liberty question. There was a story out, actually, reproductive ethics is a story out every day. But there was one today.
I missed it.
A doctor in Britain referring people for sex selection to a clinic in Cyprus. So I think in Britain, under their regulatory authority, you can't do sex selection.
Right, you can't. Non-medical sex selection.
Non-medical. Right. So if you had hemophilia, you could do that. But so anyway, he was sending them there. This was a big to-do. And just looking at the issue of gender or sex selection, curious what you think about the right of reproductive choice or reproductive liberty to do some of that design of traits when it's presumably just a taste or a preference issue, not a medically related issue. And related to that, the obligation of doctors and reproductive endocrinologists and all those other shady characters around the clinics to say, well, yes, we must honor what you wish us to do. To some extent, you know, my opposition will come out and say, I'm not sure what the argument is against letting the parent say, I want to make this choice for having a boy, and that's my preference, and other things being equal, if I sort my sperm or look at my embryos, that's sort of what I do. But the doctor may have more difficulty saying, well, is that a disease, or why would we be doing that?
Absolutely. There's no reason if you could say the woman and man have rights against state restriction on what they do, but that doesn't give them a right to have a doctor and a program offer it if they don't want to. And there are programs that have some preferences about this. Yes, there's some who want to corner the market, make a profit, will advertise and do non-medical sex selection, even though the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has not encouraged that, has said it should be discouraged. They can try to do that, but there'll be others who won't. There is an IVF program in my hometown, in my town of a transplanted town of Austin, Texas, that refused to discard embryos. That it just simply wouldn't do that. Yet here's the rub. There have been many programs that until recently would not treat lesbians. And now we want to start kicking in with some limitations on the autonomy rights of the professionals and the physicians here, and some states have bans on public accommodations based on sexual orientation. California is one of those. But some of those programs that would do procedures for lesbian would not do gay males here. That was unacceptable. The idea of a man or two men having a child with a technology that we could not countenance, but we could do women as well. Well, the same would apply there, and the ASRM has a policy guideline that you can't discriminate on the basis of either one. So I think that's obviously the doctors have rights there as well, as long as they're not using discriminatory criteria with the debate over what's discriminatory. But you know, sex selection is the really interesting thing. It's easy to push buttons on that. And of course, if you are a strong supporter of reproductive autonomy, you would say, at least in the US, why should non-medical sex selection matter? Just think of the case of the couple that wants to have a girl as the first child. Should they be denied the right to have a girl? How is that sexist? Choosing to have a girl here. We hear stories in China and India and other Asian communities. Yes, they'll want to choose a male, and that further instantiates the male dominance that is harmful for women. But that's not the case in the U.S. And even if you think there should be a limitation on the first child that should apply either way, what about the subsequent children? What about gender variety in the family? You've seen the movie The Fighter with six girls and two brothers, and I was with someone last night who has one of four sisters. Well, I've known people who wanted to who they've had two boys and they want to have a girl. And for non-medical reasons, do we want to ban sex selection? Now they're not gonna get pregnant and have an abortion just to be sure they have a girl for non-medical reasons. Maybe not even a medical abortion. But if they're otherwise going through IVF, is it so wrong to allow them pick that? So I think that's an area. There are actually three states that have bans on sex selection abortions. They haven't been challenged. Pennsylvania is one. If they are challenged, it'll raise this issue of reasons for abortion. And then there'll be issues of, if you could ban abortion for certain reasons, could you ban the tests on which the abortion decision hinges?
I'm just watching time here, so let's do maybe two more questions, and then I'll ask John to just stay a few minutes if you want to approach him.
I see a hand here and a hand here.
All right, you were talking about procreative liberty, and I was wondering about how far, you know, to push it. But you have now individuals with HIV who are living longer and want to have normal family lives. And but their partner is not HIV positive, so they want to reproduce, but they don't want to give AIDS or HIV to their partner. The safest way for them to do it is through assisted reproductive technology.
Right.
But there are many clinics that will refuse to accept them because one of them is HIV positive, despite the change in some of the professional guidelines. And even if they accept them, they have to be able to pay.
Right. So a couple issues with that. There are ways of preparation of sperm that can reduce the likelihood of transmission of HIV from a male positive partner. And there are issues then of treatment during pregnancy here, which can reduce the risk of transmission even more. And I think that there are programs who that would do that and will specialize that in treating such folks, and they have pretty good success rates. And so that seems to take care of the problem. The interesting working issue that I haven't addressed.
Money.
Well, money. That's an important issue. That's not an interesting issue. The most important, but is the idea of having a procedure that will lead to a child possibly with a life-shortening disease. Is that something that should not be acceptable? And here we get into the famous wrongful life problem that some of you in Twilight are familiar with. Are you harming an individual whose only way to be born, since that individual could not have been that individual, could not have been born but with the HIV, because it would have been a different individual. Are you harming or wronging an individual who could not be born but with the use of a technique or procedure that causes the very concern that you're involved with? And so this is an issue that goes beyond HIV transmission, which is largely manageable by good clinical and medical practices, but it goes to the deaf parents wanting to have the deaf child, the chondroplasia parents wanting to have the child of short stature. It even goes to intentional diminishment, the Blade Runner scenario, where you want to engineer an offspring with less than the full traits that it otherwise had. Yes, it could have been born without that, but you wouldn't have brought it into being unless you could have intentionally diminished it. And so this brings us back to our view of, is this a person-based view of harm, or is it a more utilitarian-based view? So, isn't it interesting how little questions about, little important questions about HIV and many of the procedures open up a whole universe of deep philosophical questions. Yes?
I had the opportunity to spend a year in the Emirates. I just returned from there recently.
From where?
From the United Arab Emirates.
Emirates. Yes, sorry.
And I was doing research on assisted reproduction over there. So in October, the headlines was that first baby was born from a frozen embryo. And then 3 months later, there was suddenly a ban in the country on frozen embryos. And there happened to be 80,000 frozen embryos at that time, which were just put on hold. Now, one of the things that's very different in the Emirates than from here is that they get full support for their assisted reproduction, so money is not an issue. So I'm just curious what your thoughts would be. You mentioned that in Texas you're not allowed to discard frozen embryos.
No, you are. It's just as one program. Didn't want to participate.
Okay.
You are.
Okay. And so what would your thoughts be on having 80,000 embryos? Frozen embryos all the time you put on hold, and what would happen in the U.S.?
Next headline is massive embryonic stem cell program.
Yeah, exactly. We actually thought about that. But what would happen if money was removed from the picture? If these services were covered here in this country too, how would that change things?
There are a number of issues here. One of the first major court cases here were frozen embryos in Australia. The couple, which was wealthy, died, then should the embryos, if they were thawed and placed in a surrogate, would they inherit the estate? So you say money's not involved, without money in the procedure, I assume they're not inheritance issues at stake here as well. But the issue you raised, and in England, a few years ago, they had to destroy or discard frozen embryos that have been frozen for more than 10 years. There's a 10-year limit on them, and there was a an ethical brouhaha about that, but one was most observed, the law that was passed, and a lot of embryos were discarded. Some people took them elsewhere in New York. But the important lurking issue in what your question raises, if IVF were funded, this would have a big impact on the number of embryos transferred in an IVF cycle. Something I haven't really talked about, but perhaps the most important issue in IVF now is a high rate of twins. Multiples, twin plus higher order multiples have largely been introduced, but a third of IVF births are twins. Yes, twins are desirable. I'm sure there's some twins here. Maybe not, but twins are desirable, but from a public health perspective, they're more impact on the pregnancy is shorter, it's more premature, they're higher costs, it's riskier. So if IVF were covered, there'd be less pressure to transfer more than a single embryo in healthy women here. And so that'd be a very important coverage. Where there's insurance coverage, it's easier to go to a single or two embryo transfer policy, which has a real possibility of cutting down on the number of twins, because doesn't mean that the woman, if the single embryo doesn't implant, doesn't mean she has to go through another IVF cycle. She'll have embryos frozen that can be used, which have a pretty good success rate. So I think that's a major issue of procreative liberty that hasn't yet been faced in the U.S. The ASRM dances around of what the limit should be. They haven't done the single embryo transfer, but in the Netherlands and Sweden and Denmark, through their insurance system, there are heavy incentives to use single embryo than frozen transfer. So money
has to be. And Ireland went that way on minimizing embryo destruction. That's how they accommodated IVF in Ireland. One embryyo at a time.
One embryo at a time. It's interesting, Robert Edwards, in his first cycle.
Gotta use him.
Robert Edwards, going back to the very beginning, that the limitation then was knowing when to retrieve eggs from a woman and how to do it. He had to come up with Patrick Steptoe, obstetrician and gynecologist, who really was a developer of endoscopy, developed laparoscopy, was a major innovator there. He didn't get the Nobel Prize as well because he died. And so it was the first cycle they did that was successful. It was a natural cycle without stimulation. One egg fertilized. And it showed, in that case, the simple embryo transfer policy worked out. In other cases, if you say you can only fertilize one egg, that places a heavy burden on a woman who has not been able to produce other eggs and freeze them or fertilize them. The woman would have to go through IVF again. If it's costly, that's going to be, there's the cost plus the intrusion on the woman. So I would argue that a constitutional theory of procreative liberty should set limits on the state being able to restrict the number of embryos fertilized or created. The question whether they could limit the number transferred, if you had then frozen embryos that could be used on a later cycle, is a closer question that we can talk about later. But your point about money and the Emirates leads us back to the very beginning and Ireland, and interesting how these different issues are.
So, well, thank you. John is up to it. He can stay informally just to chat for a few minutes.
I believe that experience.
I think
I got to do
something
if there is no governmental regulation and they decide to force the legally
and you guys can run all that and start
contractual
I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate new medical school.
How are you?
Oh.